This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. When Dinam Mengistu won a MacArthur Foundation grant in 2012 after the publication of his first two novels, he said he was interested in adding to the complexity and levels of the immigration narrative in America. He has certainly done that with his third novel, All Our Names, set in the 1970s. It's a story with two narrators, a mysterious Isaac, who is living in the Midwest on a student visa, having left Uganda in the throes of a violent conflict. Helen is his case manager, who has lived a predictable and circumscribed life. They soon begin a romantic relationship. Dinam Mengistu explores many things in this novel, including love, identity, violence, race, dislocation, and immigration. He fled the Ethiopian Civil War with his parents when he was just a toddler, and he's been living in the United States ever since, and he joins us on Radio Times. And congratulations on your book, and nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
And nice to have you here, and I'd love with to have you begin with a reading from the very beginning of your book.
Thank you.
Sure.
When Isaac and I first met at the university, we both pretended that the campus and the streets of the capital were as familiar to us as the dirt paths of the rural villages we had grown up and lived in until only a few months earlier, even though neither of us had ever been to a city before and had no idea what it meant to live in such close proximity to so many people whose faces, much less names, we would never know. The capital in those days was booming with people, money, new cars, and newer buildings, most of which had been thrown up quickly after independence in a rush fueled by ecstatic promises of a socialist Pan-African dream that almost 10 years later was still supposedly just around the corner, that according to the president and the radio was coming any day now. By the time Isaac and I arrived in the capital, many of the buildings had already begun to show signs of wear, having been neglected or completely forgotten. But there was still hope in the brighter future to come, and we were there like everyone else to claim our share. On the bus ride to the Capitol, I gave up all my names my parents had given me. I was almost 25, but by any measure much younger. I shed those names just as our bus crossed the border into Uganda. We were closing in on Lake Victoria. I knew Kampala was close, but even then I had already committed myself to thinking of it only as the Capitol. Kampala was too small for what I imagined. That city belonged to Uganda, but the capital, as long as it was nameless, had no such allegiances. Like me, it belonged to no one, and anyone could claim it.
And that's our guest, Dinam Mengistu, reading from the very beginning of his novel called All Our Names. This is Isaac. That's the chapter that Isaac is telling his story. He has 13 names, telling us that his family, I guess, goes back for, 13
yeah.
generations. And the names are both an identity, but he also says, I felt as if I had been born into a prison.
Yeah, and that's one of the interesting things that I wanted to explore in the novel, was the way in which we somehow need to reinvent ourselves, and that's one of the sort of rights and privileges and losses that come with migration, and that when people leave home, one of the things they're also leaving behind is a part of their own history. And there's a great freedom that comes with that. And Isaac is on the more positive side. He's trying to let go of that past. He's trying to give himself the space to imagine a new world for himself.
And many immigrants who have come to this country either shed their names or they're given new names, and the kind of identity that goes along with that.
Yeah, exactly. And even though he sheds those names when leaving his home in Ethiopia in order to come to Kampala, I was very aware that there was almost a very uniquely American act that was happening inside of that, you know, the sort of history of migration in this country, of people coming here, leaving their homes, dropping new names, inventing new names for themselves even after they are here. And that's always seemed to be one of the special privileges of America, or that we tend to associate with America, that you have the right to recreate yourself every generation, and that every generation is obliged to do so.
I said to you, and I have to say this, I say this to every guest who's in the studio, this is how I say your name, correct?
Yes.
And you said actually you and your dad had for a time a different pronunciation on your first name.
Yeah.
How did he say it?
Well, when my father gave me my name, he was already in the U.S. and I was born in Ethiopia, and I was born in a time of, you know, sort of great conflict in the country. And my father had this idea that he wanted to invent a new name for his son, someone who would represent the sort of change, the sort of radical change that had happened in the country's history. So he came up with Dinau, which if you ask any Ethiopian, they've never heard of before.
And people
oftentimes
totally made up name.
Completely made up name, drawn from two different languages in Ethiopia. So for a long time, we've had this sort of debate about not only what does my name mean, but how do you even pronounce it?
And how do you pronounce it? Or how do you pronounce it now?
I'm fairly flexible. I tend to lean towards Dinao, but for a long time I said Dinao. Very subtle differences, but you know, they're important.
Right. This story is set in Uganda. It's the 1970s, right? I mean, you don't name it particularly, but clearly a time of great turmoil in this country. Yeah. Why did you choose that time and place?
The initial drive was that I really wanted to write from a moment of optimism, actually. So the novel began with this idea that there was this sort of small window of time after the end of colonialism where there was a sort of great intellectual fervency happening across the continent and the sort of belief that there was a bright Pan-African future waiting. And then slowly those dreams began to wither as you watch these men who had been independence leaders morph into tyrants and dictators. And so what I was curious about was trying to capture some of that optimism, but really what happens when that optimism starts fading away? What happens when people realize the dreams that they had invested so much in were now being slowly robbed from them?
And this is the Isaac who's telling this chapter of the story, wanting all the things that the future possibly in Kampala would offer him.
Exactly. And being able to witness that demise, not only in the sort of spirit of the people, but also very much in the topography of the city. So you can actually watch these cities slowly decaying under the corruption and neglect that happens as the regimes become more interested in their own survival rather than the future of their countries.
And without giving too much away, he becomes friends with another Isaac, or someone who calls himself Isaac. Sometimes it's a little unclear. But we have these two, in a sense, two Isaacs. And I have to say, it feels like a love affair, the way you describe the relationship between these two men.
It is. It is very much a love affair. I tend to think of the novel as perhaps more than anything being a series of portraits of love. And there are different types of love throughout the novel. And the first love is the love between these two young men and the friendship that that really makes them at home for the first time. So they both have left their homes and their families. And now they're on this college campus together, and really the only thing they have to hold on to is each other. And it's through each other that they can begin to have these sort of grand, slightly implausible dreams. But the ability to dream only makes sense when they have somebody else standing next to them.
Yeah, who can share that dream.
Exactly.
Although they're very different, these
they
two Isaacs.
Dreams. Yeah. One is much more of, the narrator really aspires to be a writer. He comes to Kampala with the sense that there was this sort of great literary conference and that he can reinvent himself through the legacy of that conference. And the other Isaac has more populist dreams. He wants to be an active agent. He wants to be an active agent of change inside of his country. And there's something, self-serving about both of those dreams, definitely.
Well, and there's some interesting things. The Isaac, the revolutionary, is explaining the world to the other Isaac, and he says, to understand a real revolutionary, you have to look at their shoes. That was one thing that really caught my eye. And I guess the fancy shoes meant that perhaps you were just the weekend warrior.
Because, what I'm always interested in is how you can sort of bear witness to these sort of small divisions in a society and this idea of an open space that these college students are trying to create these new democratic movements, and yet even within that you can realize that there's still a lot of radical divisions that happen. Yeah. And the way these characters notice those divisions is by this telltale signs of who has the privilege of coming to campus in a car versus those of us who have to walk.
And all the rich boys are named or are called Alex, which I thought was pretty hilarious. Why Alex?
The characters decide that their way of responding to the fact that they'll probably never get to really be university students, that they'll never actually attain the dreams that they make for themselves, is by kind of attacking the rest of the world around them. So they attack the privileged students by renaming them all Alex, because they believe that they all arise from one uniform mass of privilege. And by doing so, you can decontextualize these people. You can say, it's okay, I don't know you. You can't hurt me anymore because you're no longer a person. You're just this thing that I've decided to name as being privileged. And by privilege, they say Alex.
And what we see and read about is this sort of growing, I don't know if it's a revolution. It's hard to tell sometimes. Yeah. Is this growing violence? And you said something interesting to Lynn Neary on NPR. He says, one of the things that I've found as working as a journalist and specifically covering conflicts and trying to meet men who at some point in their time were or are in the process of becoming their own sort of revolutionary-like figures, I found that there's a total randomness to it, a randomness not only to how they came to power, but to their causes and their sort of logic to why they began the violence, which I thought was just this sort of weird evolution of violence.
Yeah, and I think part of what happens is you have you have this sort of frustration. You have a political frustration with the state and leaders that have failed you. And as a result of that frustration, you have these retaliations that arise. I mean, people don't have any other means of expression. Violence becomes that form of expression. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of these revolutionary-like figures, there are men who are really just want something better for their country initially. And that initial desire takes a violent tinge pretty quickly. You know, they realize that they don't have the means to express that desire. And so they raise arms. They move to the bush rather than moving to the streets of the capital. And by doing so, they begin to take on this sort of revolutionary rhetoric.
Right.
Even though that rhetoric is no longer attached to any real political intent, it's just a desire for change.
One of the leaders is a guy named Joseph, and this is Uganda. So, of course, I thought of Joseph Kony.
No.
I don't know whether you were thinking about him as you were writing about Joseph.
No, he was actually
Joseph's War.
Yeah, he was loosely based on a series of men that I'd met in Sudan and in Eastern Congo. One who was a real revolutionary figure in some ways, and I think kind of disappointed many people by turning into the person that we all sort of feared that he would become. And another was a colonel in the Ugandan and the Congolese military who was espoused a certain rhetoric of violence, but also at the same time really loved his country and really wanted to make it into a better place and believed that the military was the only way for him to do so. So that's what I was curious in characters who straddle those complex lines, who are not only men capable of violence, but men who do so out of a desire to make something better for themselves and their country.
Taking just what you said, does it feel more real to write about that, what you just said, as a novel versus as a piece of journalism, which I know you've done?
Yeah. You know, journalism is a wonderful way to kind of complicate already familiar narrative. It's a way to say, like, we tend to understand the legacies and narratives of violence in very simple terms, whether they happen in Africa or inside of our own country. Mm-hmm. So you can begin to complicate that as a journalist. As a novelist, you can really dig deeper. You can not only create and invent characters based on people that you've known, but you can show the effects of their actions in a much more profound and in a much more complex way, where the readers are really invited to participate in this story in a way that journalism sometimes doesn't give you the space to do so.
We're almost up in a break here, but as a writer, is that more satisfying? I mean, to use fiction to explore something like violence?
I find fiction a necessary release in a way that, and I find myself more engaged when I'm able to do so because of the time that I'm able to spend as a novelist working through these issues and working through these ideas versus as a journalist where you're dealing with your own emotional reaction sometimes and the sort of immediacy that it has to you as a person.
And a very different kind of deadline, yes?
Very different.
Well, let's take a short break. We'll get back to our conversation. And our guest is Dino Mengistu, and we're talking about his new novel. It's called All Our Names. And his other novels include The Beautiful Things That Heaven Bears and How to Read the Air. And he is the recipient of the National Book Foundation's 5 Under 35 Award and was a MacArthur Genius recipient back in 2012. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Any questions or comments, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Early learning at Beth Shalom Congregation supports WHYY. This Star 4 preschool in Elkins Park features Montessori and traditional classrooms and learning from infancy through kindergarten. Early learning at Beth Shalom Congregation now offers new tuition options for prospective congregants and language instruction in Mandarin and Hebrew. Open houses Wednesday, April 2nd, and a family gym party on Sunday, April 6th. More at BethShalomCongregation.org.
If you're not a morning person, Morning Edition, NPR's weekday news magazine, is here to help with a checklist.
Well, you could start with a splash of cold water on your face.
That helps. Then there's the shower gel or shampoo and a cup of coffee. That's very, very important.
Oh, absolutely key.
But wait, we forgot.
Morning Edition.
Ah, yes, from NPR News. Be a morning person and have a smart day.
Weekday mornings on WHYY.
I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Next time on Here and Now, a Fulbright fellow in India woke up on a train platform and didn't know who he was.
I believe that I was a pharmaceutical tourist, and I was just doing heroin throughout India with this woman named Christina, whose face I can picture right now, but who never existed.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Dino Mengistu about his new book. It's his third novel called All Our Names, a love story about an African man who leaves during an uprising in Uganda, ends up living in the Midwest on a student visa. And as he was telling us, based in part on some of the interviews that he did covering conflicts in places like Congo and Rwanda and Sudan. Dino, I'd love to have you read another section. And I should say to our listeners, there are two narrators in this novel. We heard from Isaac, yeah. And this is where we first meet Helen.
When I met Isaac, I was almost what my mother would have called a woman of a certain age. That in her mind made me vulnerable, though I never felt that way, not even as a child growing up in a house where it would have been much easier to be a boy. My mother was a whisperer. She spoke in soft tones in case my father was upset or had entered one of his dark moods, a habit which she continued after he had left. We lived in a quiet, semi-rural Midwestern town, and decorum for her was everything. What mattered most was that the cracks that came with the family were neatly covered up, so that no one knew when you were struggling to pay the mortgage or that your marriage was over long before the divorce papers were signed. I think she expected that I would speak like her, and maybe when I was very small I did, but my instincts tell me that, more likely than not, this was never the case. I could have never been a whisperer. I liked my voice too much. I rarely read a book in silence. I wanted to hear every story out loud, so I often read alone in our backyard, which was large enough that if I yelled the story at the top of my voice, no one in the house closest to us could hear me. I read out there in the winter when the tree branches sagged with ice, and the few chickens we owned had to be brought into the basement so they wouldn't freeze to death. When I was older, and the grass was almost knee-high because no one bothered to tend to it anymore, I went back there with a book in my hand simply to scream.
And again, that's our guest, Dino Mengistu, reading from his third novel called All Our Names, where we meet Helen, one of the narrators, for the first time. And Helen says, my father named me Helen for reasons he said he couldn't remember.
Yes, which was kind of a way of showing the sort of differences between Helen and Isaac. So you have Isaac, who comes with an almost excessive number of names and the baggage attached to that. And you have Helen, who feels very rooted to this particular place, to this small town named Laurel in the Midwest. And yet at the same time, she herself suffers from a similar kind of rootlessness. It just manifests itself differently. So it's not that she has too many names. She only has one. And yet at the same time, her attachment to that place, to that name, are fairly shallow to some degree.
She's a woman of a certain age. As the writer of that, what age is that to you?
Helen would be mid to late 20s. Yeah,
that's the certain age she has.
But it's the age when she would have been expected to settle into the routine of domesticity that women, especially in the Midwest and during this time, would have been the norm.
Right.
And Helen rejects some of that normative behavior. She wants to sort of, she doesn't know exactly what she wants yet, but she knows that it's not that.
I like that she has such a loud voice.
Yeah. Yeah, I wanted her to be as strong. I mean, in my head from the very beginning, when she entered the story, she did so with a very strong and fully formed personality. She was somebody who I saw as being able to take on not only this sort of role, but this relationship that becomes very complex for her.
Was that a new experience for you to have such a full-blown character?
That quick,
sort of, you know, the way characters, yeah. I guess, come at novelists or writers?
Definitely a character who is so fully formed, who is, you know, at least on paper, very different from myself. You know, I'm not a woman. I wasn't born and raised in a small town in the Midwest. I'm not a social worker. And yet Helen arrived very quickly and very fully, as if I had been or had known these. Well, I guess I've known people similar to Helen in my life.
You have?
Yeah. When my family left Ethiopia, we came to Peoria, Illinois, so we were in a very small town in the Midwest. We went to an all-white Southern Baptist church, and my first experiences with Americans were really with women like Helen, some of whom were some of the greatest supporters of our family, some of the women who babysat us on the weekends while my parents worked multiple jobs. And none of them were social workers, but many of them had never encountered a family like ours, and yet they sort of invited us in and took us in with great warmth and love that I'm so grateful for.
Well, she, Isaac, and Helen, I mean, they fall in love. They very quickly are kissing, yeah. And they're in bed together. There's a very strong attraction between the two of them.
Yeah, and part of that attraction is I think that they see something similar in each other, right? They see the sense that they're both slightly uprooted, and that they both are looking for something in someone that can reverse that feeling, that can make them feel attached to someone. So even though they know they have incredibly different histories and backgrounds, and that they live in a period where it's incredibly difficult to have an interracial relationship, and yet, despite all that, they come together, they converge, despite all the reasons why they shouldn't.
There's a scene shortly after they meet where Helen decides to take Isaac to a diner, you know, yeah. In the town where she's very well known, and she brings him there, and here's a black and white couple together in a diner, yeah. In the Midwest in the 1970s, I guess almost unheard of. And part of me felt like she was in love with the guy, yeah. And so she wanted to have a meal with him. And the other part felt like she was showing him off to those people, using him in a way.
Yeah, there's her motives, I think, hopefully shouldn't be complex. You know, there should be a certain naivete, like she should, you know, she does have this desire to want to say that, like, look, I'm progressive, I've moved on further than you in this community and this society have, and here's proof of that. And at the same time, I think there's this desire to also want to take the relationships that are very private and make them public. You know, that's how we begin to know that we're really with someone, is when we can move beyond the confines of the bedroom wall and step outside in public and say, look, this is also who I am. And the inability and the desire to do that is quite natural. But whether or not she should have known better is definitely a fault of hers. But the desire and the need to do so, I think, is quite human and necessary.
At one point, Isaac says to her, what are we doing here? What are we doing here?
And his reaction to her, you know, he's not merely a victim in that particular situation. You know, he knows eventually what's happening and the sort of the way the racism manifests itself. And he refuses to be cowed by that and refuses to back down,
right.
Even though he knows that's going to also cost something for Helen. He knows that she's going to actually perhaps suffer maybe even more than he does, because he's gone through more. He has a reserve and a maturity that she might not have yet.
Well, and she says, I mean, she wants to leave, and he says, no, we're going to sit here, we're going to eat this. And they serve him a, you know, sounds like a pretty miserable meal, obviously making some kind of a racial statement.
Yeah, definitely. And he's, you know, the sort of difference of how do you express that animosity when you feel like you're comfortable with race relations, and yet at the same time you put it through the prism of an interracial relationship, mm-hmm. and you realize people oftentimes lack the language to express what they're feeling and why they feel so sort of sometimes hatred against those things. And so it's performed through this gesture of wanting to make this man feel uncomfortable, unsettled, unwelcomed, and yet he refuses to back into that. He holds his ground very much.
Yeah. What I found interesting is that the next chapter, we're back in Uganda, and Isaac is narrating, and he's also in a bar/restaurant, a similar parallel situation, but it ends up a fight, really.
Yeah, and there's a way in which, you know, I was writing the book from one voice to the next. I would write Isaac and then Helen, and the two voices began to very much become, they were in conversation with each other, and even though they're taking place in different time periods, over the course of very different landscapes, mm-hmm. they were very much responding to one another. So the scene in the diner in the Midwest is echoed in a diner or in a cafe in Kampala, the same way that you have the university campuses in Kampala are also reflected again once more on a college campus in the Midwest.
And in Kampala, the Isaac, the revolutionary, I mean, he fights back.
Yes. He's not willing to be cowed by anyone. And it's partly because the narrator has experienced that when he does come to the Midwest, he knows what it means to resist. He knows the necessity of resisting and to not merely acquiesce to other people's demeaning behavior or their threats against you, but to really want to stand up for that. And he is, by the time I think the novel's over, hopefully you begin to understand where that desire and where that ability to do so comes from.
And that's Dino Mengistu, our guest today on Radio Times, the author of now three novels, the third one just published called All Our Names. And he was born in Ethiopia, came to the U.S. when he was just 2 years old, and has been living in the country ever since. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Any questions or comments about the novel, you can send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Coane. Do you have memories at all of Ethiopia? You were two when you left.
No, I don't have any memories that were my own. But I always say, even though you may not have the particular memories that you get to grow up with, you grow up with other sets of memories that you inherit from your family. So I didn't have any specific memories of Ethiopia, but I grew up very aware of the loss. So I grew up inheriting the sense that, you know, there are family and friends in a landscape that had been taken away, and that even if I couldn't remember them, I grew up longing for them.
Feeling that from your parents?
Definitely.
The kind of
so.
Longing loss that they felt?
Yeah. And one of my earliest childhood memories was the death of my grandfather while we were in Pierre, Illinois. And you realize that death makes its way into the house by late night phone calls. And so you come home or you wake up in the middle of the night and you realize your parents are crying over somebody who you know you were once close to as a child, but you have no memory of anymore. Wow. And so you can't join them in their grief, but you can join them in the sense that something irretrievable has been taken away.
Helen remarks about Isaac, about his, quote, special loneliness that came from nothing that was truly yours.
Yeah, and that's some of it. You know, there was a family member of mine in London once told me that he's been in London for 30 years and that his children have been raised there, but that he'll never be at home because this part of him is always, you know, back home. And that's because he feels like he doesn't own anything. He can't own anything in this country. And I don't believe that is necessarily permanently the case. I think initially when you arrive, you're obliged to either make new attachments and find ways of, mm-hmm. of not relinquishing the old ones, but of making space in your heart and in your mind for other things and other people.
Were you able to do that? You yourself?
For me, it was very easy. I had to kind of tread and do the opposite. I had to make space for Ethiopia as I grew older. I had to sort of actually reclaim a country and a history that, you know, as you become a child and a teenager in the Midwest, what you're most interested in is fitting in. So you play baseball, you play basketball. What you don't want to do is have parents who have strange accents when they come to pick you up at school. As you grow older, you realize there's an incredible richness to this history and this culture, and that the only way you will begin to understand who you are is by finding a way to meld these two facets of your identity.
Well, all teenagers are embarrassed about their parents. Were you particularly embarrassed about them, do you think?
Oh.
Because of... they had to have had some accents.
No, they did, and I would never say that I was particularly embarrassed of them. You know, I was fortunate when I was younger to grow up in a suburb of Chicago where all of my friends had family with accents. You know, my best friends were Vietnamese, Colombian. One came from a German, like recent German immigrants. So we all loved this sort of multiplicity. It was only as we grew older that we realized that the childhood innocence that preserves and respects that multiplicity actually gets winnowed away and slowly becomes defined by a desire for a singular narrative, for people to say, well, you are from here and you are from here and you are from here.
And I think for some immigrant families, they turn their back on their past, and it's all in front of them. And for some, there is that very divided feeling of having left behind so much that they loved and that was so familiar.
Exactly. And for us, it was always that sort of mix. You know, at some point in time, my parents would say, remember that you're Ethiopian, and then you would go outside and eat a hot dog and play baseball, and you would begin to wonder, well, what does that mean? Since you can't just, it's not enough just to say it, right? You actually have to find your way of forming that attachment yourself.
So how have you resolved that for yourself?
You know, by and large, I think I wrote my way into it. You know, by my first novel and the novels since then have come with characters that oftentimes have biographies, backgrounds that are either similar to mine or similar to people that I've known and yet are here in America. And so to some degree, you make space not only for yourself in your imagination, but hopefully on a larger cultural landscape. You make space for these people, for you to exist and to say, well, here we are. We are both, you know, Ethiopian and African, and we are both also American at the same time. And these identities are held in tandem and not in opposition.
One of the things that you have said about, since you are a writer, about American writing or even literature, is in many ways it's always an immigrant story. I mean, that's our contribution to literature.
And it's our contribution. It's one of the sort of, I think, great benefits of this country is that it lacks a singular narrative, that the country is sort of always obliged to reshape and redefine itself. So even though at times people may say, well, this is what it means to be an American, that argument is always lost because it's never the case. And so every generation adds to the complexity and the layered meanings of what this American identity, what this project is that we get to do here. And that's a very special place to occupy in people's lives. And one of the things that I'm sort of most respectful for this that we have here.
And were you a kid that you know, wrote stories when he was in second grade or something like that?
Yeah, I was. I was definitely the kid who loved to spend more time with books. And then as I grew older...
More books than baseball or both?
Probably definitely more books. I was never that good at baseball, so I didn't have much choice. And then by the time I was in high school, I realized books became a way of relieving a lot of that anxiety of, you know, my school had a strong racist streak inside of it. And books became that space that allowed me to relieve some of that frustration and anger. And I realized that, well, if I don't fit into this place, to this school, to this culture, then that's okay, because at least here's literature.
Here's a place
stories.
I can go.
Yeah. And so books became my refuge, by and large. I mean, dramatically so.
You talk about a racist streak in your school. What do you mean? What does that mean to you?
It was, well, in that case, it was a very obvious. I mean, the school was predominantly one ethnicity. It was predominantly white and fairly upper class, and we were sort of, you know, working class minority families, and there weren't many of us in the school. You know, we were insulted, you know, yelled at, name called all the time in class, in the hallways, you know, which creates easily a sort of a passage of animosity and anger for me, definitely at a period when I was quite young in my life, but then also resolved itself by finding my way into books and then by finding my way into writing.
So, I mean, it toughened you up in a weird, saying
but
that.
But it does. It toughens you up and it gives you a sense of how nice it is to be alone.
And
it's a great privilege, actually. You know, it's, you begin to understand that you are the one who can construct your identity and construct what it means for you. And when you begin to go through that process, one, you deny people the privilege and the right to actually assault your own identity. And two, you begin to kind of work your way into a more generous space where you realize other people may find fault in who you are based on whatever insecurities and anxieties that you have, that they have, but that you don't actually have to do the same in return. You know, and that's, I think, a great privilege to have received that lesson.
I mean, this book is about names, but I mean, it really is about identity, yes? I mean,
very much.
Names is a kind of stand-in for identity, or the shifting identities that we all have.
Exactly, and I think it's the idea that we all have multiple identities, that we tend to think of our stories as being really singular, that we come from X town and therefore we are entirely that, when in fact we shift our roles in life constantly. So you're a son one day and you become a father the next. Mm-hmm. You take on different roles, you take on different identities throughout the course of your life, and it doesn't mean that you lose other ones or you leave other ones behind, but that your narrative, your own personal story, grows increasingly complicated, and the more open you are to that complication, hopefully the richer and more beautiful your life becomes.
Well, I also think, and I would say this about myself, I think it's true of a lot of people, is that you're different with different people.
Exactly.
You use language differently, sometimes even body language differently, because of who your audience is or who you think you're talking to.
Very much so. And you know, when I'm more oftentimes working as a journalist in Africa, my first identity for me when I'm working, and also oftentimes for the people that I'm talking with, is as an Ethiopian. And that identity also switches and becomes American when it needs to be. And it's for me, it's not that I'm switching or flip-flopping, but all of these identities are held at the same time.
Well, and I also think it's sort of knowing where you are and how to be in that context.
Exactly.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Dino Mengistu. And again, his third novel has been published. It's called All Our Names. His other novels titled The Beautiful Things That Heaven Bears, that was came out in 2007, and How to Read the Air in 2010. And again, he won the MacArthur so-called Genius Award back in 2012. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Thomas Jefferson University School of Population Health supports WHYY and offers a fully accredited master's degree in public health. An open house will be held at 5:30 p.m. Tuesday, March 25th in the school's offices on the 10th floor of 901 Walnut Street. Registration online at jefferson.edu/openhouse. The Thomas Jefferson University School of Population Health, bringing health and healthcare together.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. If you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes on our show, here's your chance to find out. On a special Fresh Air broadcast, Friday, March 28th, our producers and I will answer your questions about how we put the show together. To submit your questions, go to the website whyy.org/askfreshair. That's whyy.org/askfreshair. So tell us what you want to know, then tune in March 28th.
Feedback. for how and what we're doing is everywhere. It can be direct, indirect, it can be verbal or nonverbal. We know it can come not only from the outside world, but also inside ourselves. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, we'll speak with Harvard professor Sheila Heen about how we can use feedback we find everywhere to improve our lives. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Dino Mengestu about things like love and identity and violence and race and dislocation and immigration, all things that he writes about in his new book, his novel called All Our Names. I'm curious about whether you see your three novels connected in some way, someone who wrote them, whether you see threads or strands that connect these stories.
Oh, definitely so. All three novels are incredibly intertwined in my imagination, and almost after I almost finished my first novel, the second novel was already working its way through, and after I finished the second novel, this novel was already beginning to emerge. And all three stories, they connect around these sort of ideas of displacement, of what happens when you have to recreate yourself. But the first two novels were also very much stories that I tend to think of as being born of rupture, the stories that are born of what happens when people lose homes, lose families, and are forced to come to another country. And while that's similar definitely in this novel, I was also really curious about what happens when these storylines begin to converge, when they begin to sort of unite and find themselves pressed next to one another. And so the stories of Isaac and Helen was one way of literally on the page actually forcing these narratives together, mm-hmm. of saying, well, here's a story of a man in Africa, and here's the story of a woman in America. And if you lay them out side by side, you can begin to see how closely they resemble one another, and that one story is not unknowable or radically different from the other, but they're incredibly, you bring it to the scale of the personal and the individual, mm-hmm. and you begin to find echoes inevitably.
I mean, and obviously reflecting a place where you are.
Very much so, exactly. And because I am in the sort of the embodiment of that in many ways, you know, I realize that, you know, I come from a background in Africa and very much raised in the Midwest and have spent time in other parts of the world, and that those stories move with you, and they also become a part of this country's narrative as well.
Did you have teachers who saw your gifts as a writer that encouraged you?
In college I definitely did. I had a couple of wonderful professors who would joke to me that, you know, when I was 20, I wrote like an old man, and that I should find a way.
What does that mean?
Probably that I took myself too seriously.
Okay.
And that I didn't know how to have fun when I wrote. Which I
was
think,
that true?
I do. I take great joy when I write. But oftentimes that joy is expressed in trying to figure out what's really complex, and sometimes the humor is embedded inside of that for me. But my great pleasure in writing is actually finding ways of making what are the emotions and feelings that I find to be the most profound and the most universal expressed. So it might not always be ha-ha funny, but right. But there's joy there.
Well, this I thought was pretty funny. At one point, Isaac, the two Isaacs, if I can call them that, put together a list of crimes against the country.
Yeah.
And it's sort of, and this was their flyer. I'd love to have you just read a couple of lines of the crimes against the country.
It is a crime against the country to fail to report any crimes committed against the country. It is a crime against the country not to know what is a crime against the country. It is a crime against the country to ask, what is a crime against the country? It is a crime against the country to think or say there are too many crimes against the country.
Yeah, and the list goes on yeah. from there. I chuckled when I read
yeah.
that. I smiled.
It is, and it's one of those ways in which those are crimes being listed by government bureaucrats, and it ties into this ideas of names. So one of the more powerful things that happens with language. Language is power. It's the ability to name things. It's the ability to say this is X and that is Y and you are X and you are Y. And so this list of crimes against the country becomes one of the ways in which this sort of increasingly totalitarian regime dictates to people what are the crimes, what are the things they can and cannot do. And you can recognize the sort of absurdity in that, right? What they're more interested in is a form of control that's not possible.
Do you worry? I mean, you have gone to some pretty war-torn and violent and I'm assuming dangerous places of the world, some countries in Africa, Sudan, Congo, other places. Do you have to sort of steel yourself before you go to be vigilant and
yeah.
alert and aware?
You know, I think what you most of the time, you know, in some places the conflict is are fairly low level, so they're long simmering forms of rebellion that exists across a large landscape, and so most of the time you're probably fairly okay as a journalist. But you know, a good friend of mine, Matt Power, recently passed away working in Uganda, and he passed away just working not on any story of violence, but just by being too far away from any form of aid, and had a heat stroke and passed away as a result of that. So those are dangers that you are always occupied in the back of your mind, and the things you worry about more is really for me about how faithfully can you actually reflect these stories of trauma and give them the dignity and the complexity they deserve, so that you don't want to just feel like I'm out there asking people to share their stories with me so I can sort of list them and categorize them for people who then read them and digest them and then forget about them. But how can I actually try to do more with these stories than I feel like has been done before? Or how can I add another layer of political and emotional complexity that I may not be capable of doing to some degree? That's my biggest anxiety. Mm-hmm.
So are you a reporter with a tape recorder or with a pen and pencil and a piece of paper? Or how
always,
do you work?
Always with both. You know, I always need a translator around me.
Do you?
And oftentimes the thing that, in addition to what people tell you, is you're also looking for how they tell you their stories. There's many ways in which people use not only language, but their gestures, the way they look at you in the eyes or don't look at you in the eyes, the way they point out the window. One man in Sudan drew lines on the sand for every single person and his family that had passed away, which was just a sort of profound and intimate gesture that made me feel his story in ways that just recounting it wouldn't have done. So you're doing both. You know, you're listening and at the same time you're watching as closely as you can.
How many lines in the sand did he draw, do you remember?
He drew eight.
Eight?
Yeah.
Does it, I mean, but is, when you're working in a, as a journalist, to just to hear the stories like that and perhaps hear them repeated, you know, in many different versions, how do you defend against the sense of outrage or vulnerability or
I think
exhaustion?
The exhaustion definitely comes, you know, and you come home and you bring that back with you. What I worry about more is how to work against the sort of seemingly mundanity of it. You know, the fact that these stories can easily become overly familiar, or we think they are familiar to us because all we begin to see are our body counts or stories of this is ethnic violence or this is religious violence. And when we begin to categorize things in those very simplistic terms, we exclude the possibility of a deeper form of engagement. And so what you try to do is figure out how not to let those terms become the dominant forms of discourse, how to actually rescue the individual lives and the complex political realities that infuse those lives away from a kind of banal rhetoric.
Well, and there's a stereotype, you know, the Africa, the kind of basket case, right? That there's nothing good comes out of Africa.
Of course, and you tend to believe sometimes that story has, that narrative has worked its way out of the popular imagination, and yet at the moment that you see a conflict erupting, you tend to see how quickly we resort to old uses of language, how quickly we use sort of total terms like hell or ethnic violence, when in fact you realize, you know, ethnic violence is just a construct of politics. It's men and women sometimes who choose to use one form of allegiance over another to maintain power. The idea of ethnicity is a very malleable one, as is the idea of religious violence. You know, those are tools of politics the same way they would be in this country.
There's a scene where there really is a massacre, and Isaac the writer is responsible for the burial of all these bodies, and they all are named Adam. I mean, the name that is given to them is Adam.
Yeah, and that's his way of defending himself against that. Is, you know, he's watching these, he's, you know, looking at these mass sort of grave in the making, and what he realizes is he doesn't know how to make those stories personal anymore because he's assaulted by the degree of loss, and so he begins to call them Adam, but at the same time it's also a way of giving them a name to some degree, right? It's a way of making them, and he starts adding bit by bit these little personal stories to each one, like Adam, you could have been a doctor, Adam, you could have done so much better with your lives, and you know, by doing so, he also is able to restore a certain level of dignity to them that might be lost just in making them nameless. So even though they may only have one name, they also have a story attached to that name, and that process of giving them a narrative and a name, regardless of how generic that name may be, preserves them as more than just a body.
And is that something that you came across as a journalist?
No, that's not. Fortunately,
that's
pure imagination. It is a way in which, you know, again, like that man in Sudan who drew the lines in the sand, it is a way of trying to again, to preserve something that's mm-hmm. that's so easily lost, that so easily vanishes under the sort of veneer of death and political violence. You're trying to find a way to keep those people as people.
Well, I also think of Adam and Eve.
Of course,
I mean, you know,
very much so.
That's a quote unquote first man.
Yeah, and that's why Adam was the name that the narrator and I settled on together. In our conversation.
So, do you have a certain? I mean, it sounds like things are coming at you as a writer. Characters, storylines.
I wish they came to me as a writer. They
really?
They have to be painfully drawn out over the course of a really long time. So, you know, this novel began sort of in 2007 in many ways. In some ways, Isaac as a character started probably really forming in my imagination in 2002. Oh. Really, really early on, I had a character named Isaac in my head. I just didn't know who he was or what he did. So, you know, and it's as you start working your way through the novel, you realize that you're pulling on all these different strands of yourself. You know, you're pulling on your experiences, on your things that you've read, on stories that you've heard, on places that you've tried to, you know, push your imagination towards. And then you have to do this, you know, awful thing of trying to find the right words in which to express those things. So that's the sort of years of painstaking work.
And is it awful?
Sometimes.
To find the right words?
Oftentimes, you know, it's a sort of oscillation. You have great moments of joy when you're writing, when you have those small little breakthroughs, and you tend to hold on to those moments because they're few and far between. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you have long periods where nothing is expressed properly, and you know that, and so you have to return back and forth. But then you realize that you're mining language in order to get to something more precise, hopefully something a little bit more unfamiliar.
So do you go take a walk? Do you do the load of laundry? I mean, what do you do in those moments where the words don't come?
I tend to sit at my desk and sometimes fall asleep. And
oh,
then
is that
wake
right?
up and then go back. And then I'll have a lot of coffee and walk. And then I have two little kids who have been sort of great inspirations in that they don't leave you a whole lot of room to waste.
No,
so
true.
you have a pressure cooker kind of constantly working in the back of your head where you know there's only so many hours in the day that you can squirrel away for yourself, and you try to make the most out of them.
And do you have a room somewhere where you can go, or do you go to the local coffee shop or library or something to
To
write?
This novel was mainly written in Paris, where I lived for 5 years. And I was
lucky
really
you.
Yeah, that was a nice time. And I was very lucky to have a little office right next to my apartment, which was just a little tiny old studio. But it was just the right space and had windows that looked out really onto nothing, but still got pretty okay light. Mm-hmm. And just a desk and a small couch, and that was perfect.
What were you doing in Paris?
Meeting my wife, apparently.
Oh.
I didn't know.
Was that the reason you went there to find her?
I thought I was going just to get it. There's a great James Baldwin quote where he says, I didn't move to Paris. I left New York. And I kind of felt that way at the time, that I was getting away from a certain familiar terrain and landscape and trying to kind of rethink myself.
So where did you meet your wife since you raised it?
She worked for my French publisher.
Oh.
So
oh.
It was pretty built in.
Right. Yeah. And are you the kind of writer that sort of has to dedicate at least a certain amount of time every day to writing, or can you be a little more kind of loosey-goosey about a structure or a schedule?
Yeah. I used to like the idea of being very structured. Kind of throwing structure out the window. And you know, you find the time where you can, and you have many things that are really important to you, and writing is definitely at the very, you know, near the very top of that list, but so is my family, so are mm-hmm. other things, and so are I teach as well, and trying to make time for my students is really important. So I work oftentimes really late at night, sometimes early in the morning if I've had enough sleep, which isn't often, but I tend to believe being malleable is pretty essential.
Mm. And do you keep notebooks? I mean, if you're hearing snatches of conversation or something that looks right, are you scribbling things down?
I've never done that. I wait until generally I don't have that many ideas. So one idea comes to me every few years, and then I sit on it in my head for a really long time, and I have this like ongoing conversation for months, oftentimes before I begin to even get the first sentence down. And then once that process begins, the years I go into writing a novel, I'm oftentimes very much trying to avoid any outside influence or distraction. Yeah. So I go back to rereading a lot of books and rereading a lot of poetry, because I worry about the way other voices or other stories will work their way into mine. And so I'm having a conversation quietly, you know, daily, hourly, even when I'm not writing with the characters, with the language in my head.
Are there certain poets that you read?
Yeah.
Or does it matter?
No, it definitely matters. Every book seems to sort of align itself with different types of language. My first novel owed a lot to Emily Dickinson and to Dante, and my second one to Rilke.
Oh. How about this one?
And this one with William Carlos Williams. There's a lot that I reread him a lot.
Oh, I'm thinking of The Wheelbarrow and those very strong and colorful images.
Yeah, and very like distilling, making meaning out of very small moments is one of the wonderful things that he does. He takes a sort of seemingly banal observations and somehow elevates it to a space of poetic meaning.
And we're almost out of time here, but I'm just curious about when you're done a novel. You've written three. Do you know when you're done? Or is it just at some point you just say...
That's it.
That's it?
This novel has a pretty final conclusion. When I wrote the last lines of this novel, and I didn't know what they would be, but I felt them coming weeks in advance, and I was trying to find ways of isolating time and more time in order to get them down. And when they came, I knew that was it. I knew those were the final lines. I knew the book was terribly flawed and needed to be reworked and needed to be edited and all sorts of things, but I knew that the sentiment, the emotion that comes through in the last few pages was exactly what the book had been trying to argue for the whole time.
And that took a while for you to find the words.
Yeah, and then once they arrived, I was, one of the few moments of gratitude that you have.
Well, it's been a great pleasure, and thank you so much, and congratulations on your book. Thanks for joining us today on Radio Times. And again, Dinu Mengistu, our guest, and his third novel is titled All Our Names. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. You can carry on a conversation on our homepage. You can also check us out on Twitter and Facebook and download a podcast of the show. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, and it's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Bilder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moskowain. Thank you so much for joining us.